Welcome to another episode of the Fuel Your Fandom podcast. My name is Saint. I'm glad you could all join me again for what seems like month 76 in this quarantine thus far. I hope your families aren't driving you too crazy. I hope you have enough food in your pantry, and I hope you have enough toilet paper to wipe your ass. But that all being said, I want to thank you for joining me again for another episode. As always, you can always find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fuelyourfandom, or you can find us on our Anchor homepage, which is anchor.fm/fuelyourfandom. That'll give you the link to find us on all the different podcast sites, such as Google, Spotify, Apple, yada, yada, yada. The list goes on. Also, a big shout out to our sponsor with Seattle Wave Radio. I'm sure by now you guys have all checked that out, and I appreciate that. But once again, we are on a topic of, we're going to try and stay positive because Lord knows there's enough negativity out in the world. And so I've been trying to gear the podcast in a bit of a more positive direction. I mean, I'm no John Krasinski, and God bless whatever he's doing these days, but I try to keep it on a positive front. So with me today, I have a special guest. His name is Mark Rahner. He is a comic book writer. He is a journalist, movie reviewer, etc., etc. Mark, I want to welcome you to the Fuel Your Fandom podcast.
I'm glad to be with you, but I have to tell you that if you wanted to focus on positivity, I think you booked the wrong guest.
Well, I mean, positivity in that we're not going to talk about this situation as it's unfolding now. There's, Lord knows there's enough people talking about it who know a lot, hell of a lot more about it than I do. I'm going to keep the pursuits to the geekier aspects of life.
No promises, but let's see how it goes.
So, Mark, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and your career? I know you do comic books. I know you've done journalism, but can you kind of expand on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell where to start, but you are probably talking to me because of the comic books. I've been a comic book writer since about roughly approximately 2009, when I did an independent horror Western comic called Rotten. And that was right around the same time that I also co-wrote a comic for Boom Studios called Galveston with Tom Pyre, who used to be an East DC editor and is now running his own company, Ahoy Comics. You should check Ahoy out.
I will, definitely.
They're very good. And I did a story in their anthology called Edgar Allan Poe's Snifter of Terror. So I started around then, about 2009, about 11 years ago, when I was still a journalist with the Seattle Times. I could kind of see the writing on the wall for print journalism. And I was also getting very frustrated at the time that about the only straight talk you could really see in news was in the late night comedians, and regular news outlets were just really going out of their way to not even be able, you couldn't count on them even to say the obvious. And so I kind of did my own small scale version of a Rod Serling and wanted to go into a venue where I could talk about stuff, even if it was under a pretext of fantasy and grotesque sociopathic violence and stuff like that. So there was the comic book career begun. My independent comic, Rotten, it got a lot of very generous, kind, nice reviews, and that opened some other doors for me. And I did a lot of work for Hire. After that, I wrote The Green Hornet, a lot of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars stuff that people can check out, Vampirella, Army of Darkness, and Tarzan, quite a number of other things.
Yeah, and I was introduced to your work through Brandon Jerwa and also through Eric Trotman, who are friends of mine, and they were kind enough to introduce us. But they introduced me to a lot of your, I had kind of a wide swath of your work to look through. And the thing that immediately caught my eye was your work with the Twilight Zone.
It's what I'm proudest of, and I'm glad you got a chance to see it. And I just cannot tell you what an influence that was on me, and how much I love Rod Serling. And we have never needed Rod Serling more than we do right now.
Oh, no, we're living in the Twilight Zone. I'm relatively sure of it.
Worse. but we'll always have him, his words with us. He already told us everything we needed to know. And when you look at his absolute righteous anger against greed and ignorance and bigotry and especially cruelty, he would have his hands full writing these days if he were still alive.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that really struck me, and it may be, I haven't had any experience with the new Twilight Zone. I've heard very good things. I haven't had a chance to experience it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as now, we talked briefly offline about the Twilight Zone, and my introduction to it was a lot of years ago, as I'm sure the case with a lot of people. But it never was anything I really paid a whole lot of attention to. It was always more kind of background information and, you know, Nick at Night type fare, if you know what I'm saying.
Sure. And, you know, we all revisit the Twilight Zone at different stages of our life, and it means different things to us when we do.
That's exactly right. And I'm actually taken by the fact at how well not just the video. The video looks great. The videos on, they're streaming them all on Amazon Prime right now. And I went down a rabbit hole with them yesterday, and I'm probably going to continue down that rabbit hole for the next foreseeable future, just because.
Oh, lucky you then. Lucky you, because there's nothing better to do with your time, especially while everybody's under lockdown. And I got to tell you, I know I interrupted you, and I apologize.
No, that's fine.
Last night, I was watching the Bomb Shelter episode. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that it nearly brought me to tears.
Yeah, and I watched Walking Distance was the one I started with last night, and for a reason. We'll talk about that here in a minute. But as I was flipping through the titles, there's so many of them that I just remember inherently, even if I couldn't tell you rope for rope what the plot details were, and it's like watching. It's like talking to an old friend. It's like you slip right back into it. And there's so much pop culture and media that is predicated on things like The Outer Limits or The Twilight Zone or coming a little farther forward into The X-Files and things like that. The paranormal type things that we are presented with that just kind of weave their way throughout pop culture. And I'm trying to think about how to phrase what I want to say here.
No, you're 100% on the right track. The Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, those were the granddaddies. They were before my time by quite a bit, and they were in reruns when I was a kid, and I digested those. It's really hard, I think, for a lot of people who are even younger than you and me to grasp how influential those were and how there was essentially nothing before those. Or even Star Trek, something like Star Trek, just how primitive science fiction and media looked before Star Trek came along. Those things are massively important and wonderful. I love them.
Absolutely. And going back now, as you say, Star Trek is really hard to watch the original series for me because, you know, we've come so far in what we can do with visual effects and what we can do with practical effects and just acting in general. What can be shown on television has changed so dramatically. So to pair up the original series with even Deep Space Nine or with, well, now certainly with Discovery and Picard, they're worlds apart, but the seeds are still there.
Well, I don't want to get us off on a tangent that's going to drive me into like spittle-flecked rage, especially because I was getting to kind of like you. We've only just met, but you seem like a good guy. But the original Star Trek is so far superior to anything that.
Oh, I agree. I agree for the fact that specifically, if we had not had that as a stepping stone, we'd have nothing now. or what we have now is would be so dramatically different, and it wouldn't be what we fell in love with.
True, true. But hear me out. My point is that it's beautiful. In addition to the fact that they told such an amazing amount of story in something like a 50-minute episode, it's just beautifully filmed. And every other Star Trek since then, especially Discovery, they're so ugly to look at. I can't even watch Next Generation. They all look like they were shot in a brightly lit abortion clinic. The original Star Trek is just great looking. And if you've ever seen, there's a fan series, I think it's called Star Trek Continues. Have you heard of that?
I have. I've not watched a whole lot of it, but I have seen some of the sets and some of the things that they've done.
Right. Not only is it awfully good, especially for a fan thing, but it's beautifully done, and it looks exactly like the old show. The sets, the lighting, right down to the specific techniques that you saw in Star Trek, where a person's in a tight close-up with sort of a bar of light across their eyes. They really have captured a lot of what made that show so beautiful.
Oh, no, I absolutely agree. And I think as the technology improves for what we can do now, it enables the common person, the lay person, as you were, to have access to the old techniques, the old style of doing things. In fact, we see a lot of that resurgence in horror as well, with the things like with what Sam Raimi and his friends did with the original Evil Dead, all shot very, very haphazardly and very, I'm trying to think of the way to say it. Practical, very, very practical.
Yeah, they went the George Romero route, 100%.
Right, but like with the original Star Trek, those techniques are now so readily available and easily accessible to anyone that it just shows that all you have to do is have that eye for it. And the people on Star Trek Continues, and I want to say Axanar as well, were both very, very good at capturing that feeling of the original series.
Yeah, it's astonishing to me that with the fact that you could put together on a not very expensive laptop now, you don't even have to have a Mac. You can generate something superior to that TV of half a century ago. And even you could generate something like Discovery. And yet you look at say Amok Time or Amok or however you pronounce it, or you know, some of the best, Sitting on the Edge of Forever. If you look at those, look at the beats, look at how far they go, the character stuff they achieve, what they accomplished in those original series episodes was an astonishing accomplishment, especially when you look at Discovery. And you know, I don't ever miss an episode because I'm a fan and a lifelong addict, probably like you are, but boy, they're just not as good.
Now, I will tell you what I find is really delicious Star Trek these days, and I don't know if you'll agree with me or not, but the Orville.
Oh, yeah, no, you're 100% correct on that. The Orville is the best Star Trek since the original, honestly.
I agree, and it's such a love letter to, well, the original series, but also Next Generation, I feel. But it's such a love letter to those original, you know, plot points and the original character arcs and things like that. It's much more driven in the same way that TOS and the Next Generation were as well.
Yeah, Seth MacFarlane gets Star Trek in a way that J.J. Abrams with his abomination, terrible movies, never could understand it.
Now, I wanted to hate the original or the new J.J. Abrams movies. I didn't hate them. I didn't love them. I thought they were cast pretty brilliantly, at least the first one.
Well, but if you don't want to hate him, here's a way to look at him that you might find helpful.
Lens flares?
No, well, that too. J.J. Abrams isn't doing Star Trek so much as he's riffing on Star Trek. That's it. That's all it is. He's riffing on it. Like, hey, what if Kirk and Spock were kind of assholes to each other when they were young? Or what if Spock and his girlfriend got in a relationship argument on the shuttlecraft when Kirk was listening and couldn't get out of the way? It's just riffing on it. He's not really doing Star Trek. And that's why it rings so empty to me. I really can't stand those things. And it's too bad, because if you love Star Trek, you get even angrier. If you were just going in as a neutral person who didn't care about Star Trek, it'd be like, it's no skin off my nose. It's just another movie. But no, God damn you for doing this to a thing I love.
Yeah, and we run across that a lot these days, because I talked about it in a previous episode, but we're very much living in a reboot remake culture, and it's really hard to have a thing held precious that you love from back in the day without it being retread and revamped and reshot and redone, and you know, a lot of people feel ruined. And
yeah, and you mentioned the reboot of the Twilight Zone, and it's always going to have reboots, and what is this, like the fourth? They're going to be up and down in quality, but you're always, always going to have the original one. Just like the ungodly bad Will Smith Wild Wild West movie nothing to harm the fantastic 4 years of original Wild Wild West and all 104, I think, of those episodes. So we'll always have the originals.
Or even closer to your heart, the Green Hornet.
You know what? I just did a binge watch of all, I think, 26? I forget how many episodes. It was only one season. That is such a beautiful show. And everybody loves Bruce Lee, rightfully so. And I don't want to start off on a tangent about his portrayal in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because it was totally reasonable. But Van Williams is great in that show. He's such a good Green Hornet, and he doesn't get much attention these days because Bruce gets all of it. Van Williams is a fantastic Green Hornet.
See, now that's a show I need to sit down and watch again. See, I used to watch that show kind of back-to-back with the 67 Batman.
66, yes.
Or 66, excuse me. And I love the original Batman. That's my Batman.
That's a good pairing, and the original 66 Batman it's another one of those wonderful shows that, depending on the age you're at when you see it, it means something different to you. And so, again, a little before my time, but I saw the reruns when I was a small child, and it imprinted on me, and of course I loved it, and I wanted Adam West to be my dad like everybody did. And then when you watch it as an adult, you see, oh God, this is just genius level hilarious. This is so funny and so well done.
Like beyond camp.
You could not possibly just dismiss that show as camp.
No, it's so far beyond that. It's kind of a thing of its own making. It's kind of its own little art form.
Totally.
It's like reducing it to saying, oh, it's just camp is selling it so far short.
And not only that, but now in the year 2020, when you can have legal marijuana delivered to your front door, the show just keeps getting better.
It just gets better. I mean, I'm not going to say you're wrong.
but I did what I said I wasn't going to do, and I got us off on a tangent.
No, this is perfect. See, this kind of gives me an insight into your head, too. And one of the things that I like to ask my guests before we really kick off into topics or anything is what is it that you are a fan of? What are you passionate about? Because my show is called Fuel Your Fandom. The entire idea behind it is to talk about your own fandoms to push your passions up and inflame your passions, but also to hear other people talk about theirs. So they can be passionate and they can be excited, and maybe, you know, cross-pollination excitement happens and you get like me, where I'm now on a Twilight Zone binge, and there you go. So we've got a little bit of insight into the things that you like. Is there anything else that you're particularly nerdy about? Or?
Well, I think like a lot of comic professionals, of course, you grow up reading and loving comics. That's a given. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got a special fondness and obsession for TV in the second half of the 1960s up until like 1969, when all the violent shows were taken off the air because of politics. I mean, that's the Wild Wild West had such a massive share of the audience that doesn't even exist in today's TV landscape. But shows like that, or Garrison's Gorillas, have you ever heard of that show?
I have not.
It only ran for one season in 1967, and it was a World War II show that was essentially the Dirty Dozen meets Mission Impossible, and it's just great. Anybody listening, you can find these episodes on YouTube, And it's not a realistic World War II show. I mean, it's complete fantasy bullshit, but it's so fun. It's so fun. But my point was that I love shows from that period, Star Trek, Wild Wild West. Twilight Zone is a little before that. It started in 59. But also Man from U.N.C.L.E., Batman, we've talked about. It was when people just started getting color TVs too, and the colors just pop. Even if you're not having weed delivered to your door, they're just they're so beautiful to look at. And it's kind of like, you know, now we've had Mad Men as a cultural touchstone. I like all those shows set in the Mad Men era, and they work better for me than watching current things now based on characters that were created during the Mad Men era. But people try to make them fit into the current times, if that makes sense to you.
They try to modernize while still being adherent to the original timeline.
Yeah, like look at all the things that we love if we're comic book fans. All the DC stuff, the original DC stuff is more than 8 decades old. All the Marvel stuff was more than 5 decades old. And, you know, it's not easy to make that relevant and not laughable in 2020. And so I really enjoy just going back into that era and watching stuff that was made then with characters that were cool then. Think of how many characters, think of what a great job Marvel did putting characters that were made way back then, including, you know, like Hawkeye and the Scarlet Witch, who had, and Thor. Mm. We had every reason to expect those to be just like laugh out loud, silly and stupid when they were put on screen, but they knocked it out of the park. They did a fantastic job.
Well, I think we have enough evidence of negative versions of those characters. I mean, if you look back at the made-for-TV Doctor Strange or the made-for-TV...
Yes, with Peter Hooten.
Oh, Jesus. You know it. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We have enough bad examples of what these comic book characters should look like, or should not look like, rather, that I think... it could only get better. Like, and you look at things like the original Captain America movies with
Reb Brown.
What was his name?
Reb Brown.
Okay. There's another one I'm thinking of.
There was more than one. You're correct. And I can't. I'm having some brain constipation right now. But those.
He was the son of a famous author.
Oh, Salinger, Matt Salinger.
Matt Salinger. There you go.
Thank you for the tip.
And that's all I remembered. It was like this random piece of trivia. But
no, the motorcycle helmet. It was unspeakably bad.
And the rubber wings or the rubber ears on the side of his owl. And the
thing, so for a little kid at the time, which I was, people can't comprehend how goddamn disappointing that was. it was so disappointing because they would advertise these things and it's all you got. I mean, you know. You got your allowance and your 12-cent comics, and they promote these things on TV, and then you see them, and it's like the equivalent of getting an ice cream cone and dropping it on the ground right away. It's so disappointing.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will have more with Mark Rahner. All right, welcome back. We are still talking with Mark Rahner. Now, Mark, you did a series of comic books based on the Twilight Zone. That was collected in a compendium, correct? Was that Dynamite?
Yeah, Dynamite. They're all original stories, with the exception that one of those stories was kind of a riff, sort of an inversion of a Twilight Zone episode, but absolutely not based on it in any other way, not a copy or a rewrite of it. Just kind of a variation on a theme, kind of like you hear about, you know, improv, jazz, they'll take a basic chord progression and then just lose their mind and go in their own direction.
Well, and that's what I wanted to talk to you about that one first anyways, because holy shit, that thing hit so close to home for me. We're referring to, there was an original Twilight Zone episode in season one called Walking Distance, where the main character pulls off for gas on the way back to his hometown. And he has to, I think he has to have the oil changed. And so as he's having the oil changed, he decides to walk to his old hometown. It's about a mile and a half away. And while he's there, he starts experiencing things that he can't explain. And long story short, it ends up being that he's back in time, back when he was a kid in this hometown. He's interacted with himself. He's interacted with his parents. And it's a really great story. Very, very, very well done story. About
it's fantastic. And the actor in that show's name is Gig Young. And he was such a gifted actor.
He was so good.
Yeah, you wouldn't remember the story nearly as well without the way he brought it to life like that, in addition to Rod Serling's astonishing writing.
Well, yeah, of course. But what I thought was great about that is in addition to, and we were talking about how the shots hold up over time, and I went to school for filmmaking. I did a few years of that. And so short film has kind of always been on my mind. And that opening shot where he's walks up to the cigarette machine, and the cigarette machine has a mirror in it, and as he walks away, instead of following him, we follow him in the mirror, and it's such a seamless transition, and it's such a beautiful shot that it blew me away, and that was what grabbed me into the episode right away. So but you did a take on walking distance called Stumbling Distance. Can you explain a little bit about that for me?
Yeah, it's really the only autobiographical comic I've ever written. All the comics that I've ever done, maybe with the exception of Vampirella and Army of Darkness, they're all about something that pisses me off. I'm a compulsive news consumer and reactor, and you know, we're talking about Rod Serling. The whole reason for the Twilight Zone was so that he could comment on things that kept on getting censored when he was just doing straight teleplays isn't the word I'm looking for. He was doing, you know, like patterns and things like that. There was the story that he'd done about a lynching. Anyway, to make a long story long, I guess. The original Walking Distance is about a guy who goes and meets the childhood version of himself, and he wants to recapture this idyllic piece of youth that he had. Mine is just the opposite. Mine is a writer who's fairly successful and goes back to his hometown for a book signing, and the writer is a bit of an alcoholic, but sort of a bon vivant who conceals it with sort of a happy-go-lucky demeanor. And he runs into the abused childhood version of himself, and he needs to decide what he's going to do about it, because doing nothing really isn't an option. And he, in the process, he meets his mother, and this is not, you know, a Back to the Future type of, hey, your mom's kind of hot, what are you going to do about that? It's meant to be kind of wrenching. And, you know, it had been on my mind. My own mom died several years ago, and I had to clean out her house in Spokane, Washington. And that's where all that came from. And the ending, I think, gives you food for thought, and I won't spoil it for people who haven't read it yet.
Oh, absolutely not. It was fantastic.
I'm glad you connected with it, and that means a lot to me, because doing good by Uncle Rod is, that's very, very important to me. And, you know, we've all read, like Gold Key had those shitty Twilight Zone comics when we were a kid. Those are unreadable.
They don't capture the same feeling.
I didn't even know that was their goal, you know. It's like, were they there to sell gum? What were they even for? But
cash grab?
I guess, but there was a lot of, like, those Gold Key Ripley's Believe It or Not, and the Dell comics, it was hard for me to tell those apart. But, yeah, I'm glad you connected with these, because when you have a good publisher, and Dynamite gave me a lot of leeway, It's important to do as much as you possibly can to get it right, and I'm glad that you liked it.
Well, the cool thing about that, and we were talking about Seth MacFarlane's love letter being the Orville love letter to Star Trek, and you could tell his passion and his fandom for Star Trek through his work on that show. Likewise, I could see that through just even if we were just to take the Serling narration that you put at the header and the footer of each comic, it sounds so very much like him that I couldn't help but read it in his voice.
That was certainly the intent, and I'm glad it crossed that way, because, you know, as a compulsive researcher, going back from my career 1.0 in newspapers, my method of doing anything like that is that I just, it's total immersion. And so even though I've already more or less knew the Twilight Zone awfully, awfully well, when I got the gig for Dynamite to do the comics, of course, the first thing I did was go blow money on the Blu-ray set and just have it on constantly, especially focusing on the narration, because it's hard to get that right. You said you watched the Jordan Peele version, and then there was an 80s version that that had, I think it had no narrator for a while, and then it had... what is the guy's name? People listening aren't going to care what the guy's name was, but he was a guest star on a few Wild Wild West episodes and kind of one of these omnipresent character actors in the 60s and 70s. Charles. This is going to bug me.
I'll look it up. You keep talking.
He played Jeremy Pike in the Wild Wild West after Ross Martin, who played Artie the sidekick, had a heart attack in one of the seasons. Charles Aidman is his name.
Okay.
So we were talking about the narration of the Twilight Zone. If you look at these things, almost nobody got it right after the originals. It's very hard to do. And I appreciate anybody that I read who does even come close to getting it right.
Well, and I had this conversation with Brandon last, I talked to him a few weeks ago. We were talking about, because he's done a lot of tie-in work as well with Battlestar Galactica, Bionic Woman, Army of Darkness, things like that. He's done a lot of work on materials that have built-in fan bases, built-in audiences. The conversation that I had with him, and I guess I can ask you about your take on it as well, is, I kind of feel like I know where you're going to go with it, but the question at that point was, what is the responsibility of the person creating the new material in keeping with the original material? What is their responsibility as far as respecting the source material? And it was Brandon's assertion that we talked specifically about Thundercats. I don't know how much experience you have with the Thundercats.
No, none. Okay. I'm not Thundercat literate, and I apologize.
Well, they've taken Thundercats was a cartoon that was in the, I want to say, mid to late 80s, and then they revamped it and brought it back out in 2011 with a bit of an edgier kind of look to it. I was a fan of both of those takes, but the reason that I brought the question up to Brandon was they're creating, I believe by now it's probably on the air, it's called Thundercats Roar, and it is, lack of a better term, we'll just say cartoonish take on it, which is funny because it's a cartoon in the first place. But,
how dare they,
right? But it's like they took like Marv Wolfman's Teen Titans compared to Teen Titans Go compare it.
Okay, all right.
And so you got what Marv Wolfman's Teen Titans were, and then you've got the silly weirdness that is Teen Titans Go. That's kind of the comparison. Like, you have the Thundercats, and then you have this new trying to be Adventure Time, trying to be Steven Universe medley of dreck.
Uh-huh.
And Brandon's assertion was that he didn't mind it, and the reason he didn't mind it was because it's not for us. It's for a new audience, and anything that gets a new audience into something that you love should be kind of accepted. What do you feel about that as regards to the Twilight Zone?
Well, I feel like the Twilight Zone is not Thundercats. Let's start with that.
clearly.
I think that in addition to trying to get Serling's voice down, or if you can't, just not having a narrator, but in addition to get Serling's voice down, you got to make it about something. I think one of the things that people lose sight of about Rod Serling is what a truly angry, and rightfully so, righteously angry liberal Rod Serling was, and how many of those episodes were a response to things going on at his time, just like you and I could turn on the news and just be like, can you believe this garbage right here? And what they're, that's what he was doing. And you must make Twilight Zone stories about something. They were not, they absolutely were not just cute little morality tales with funny twist endings. They just weren't.
Right, and neither was your writing as well. I mean, it's really easy to see something like that come across as kind of, well, like you say, light and fluffy and just kind of a, oh, what a twist moment, an M. Night Shyamalan moment or whatever you want to call it. But it's clear to me that yours wasn't.
No, he was writing with urgency and passion about serious things going on in his time. And I think if you're able to do that, you got to do that if you're trying to do Twilight Zone. But, you know, just to broaden it out, in any art, especially comics, I mean, I see people who have to be just like the biggest numbskulls on earth complaining about SJWs in comics.
Jesus, or yeah. Keep
politics out of comics. I don't want to read your stupid politics. Or And it's like they don't understand what they've been reading and watching their whole life. What do they think comics are about?
I mean, they clearly weren't paying attention.
The creators were that made the comics. Who do they think Jack Kirby was? You know, Jack Kirby wasn't a real hand wringer when it came to punching Nazis, you know?
I agree. And it's funny you mentioned that. I've gotten into conversations with people about the direction of comics and the inclusivity and the role that we all have to take as far as representation in media and pop culture. And there's a lot of people who are just woefully upset about it. Oh, this isn't the way it was supposed to be. This is, Thor was never a woman. What are you doing making Thor a woman? It's like, look, first of all, Thor was a mythological creature before he was ever a comic book. And I got news for you, pal. If you haven't read any Norse mythology, there's quite a lot of gender bending going on.
I have. It was some of the first stuff that I've read. I think that we're getting into kind of different territory, but I appreciate what you're saying about Thor. I'm not so much a fan of taking really long established characters and then swapping them out because I appreciate original female characters in their own right much more than I would say a female Thor.
Right, and that's where that conversation actually delved into is the fact that it can't be done just for doing its sake. It has to be something that means something, that is geared in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I'm more interested in seeing a female Thor than a male Wonder Woman, but if the story is good and it's got a reason and some passion behind it and even some good righteous anger, yeah, sure, do whatever works. Feel free to experiment. But the one thing I'm not interested in is just, you know, fan fiction with muscular people punching each other. It's got to be, you got to have some passion with it, and it's got to be about something. And anybody who says differently, I don't know what they've been reading. And if they have been reading the same things you and I have been, maybe they just didn't get it.
There was another story that was in the compendium that I wrote. What was the name? The compendium was named Shadows and...
The Twilight Zone, Shadow yes. and Substance.
Shadow and Substance. And
Substance is obviously a phrase taken from the intro to the show.
Okay. There was a...
world of things and ideas. Shadows and Substance. Something
I feel like you'd probably have a really good Rod Serling impression built up.
If you look online, I bet you'll find something.
there was another story that you did, and the name of it escapes me, and I apologize. I just binged a whole lot of it at once. So about astronaut who's put into captivity.
Oh, I think the title of that one is Jailbreak.
Was that Jailbreak? Okay.
I think. It's been a while since I wrote these things, so thank you for your patience. Yeah, Jailbreak was in the first two issues of the monthly series and not one of the specials. Yes, Jailbreak is about a guy who finds himself, an astronaut who finds himself in a situation that I think if you've ever seen the old 1967 Prisoner show, maybe it'll give you a little feeling of The Village, but it's definitely not The Village.
It was, and again, I don't want to spoil it for anybody. I'm not going to go blabbling about the ending, but it was, we talked a bit about the fact that you wrote all of your Twilight Zone, we'll call them episodes, issues, as if they were being filmed in the same manner that the original Twilight Zone was filmed.
With the same budget limitations and, yeah, no gigantic set pieces or things that... I didn't want to write anything for the artist to draw that couldn't have been done in the show with their own limitations.
Right, and not for nothing, but I feel like that's also what helped lend itself to the feeling of it being a natural extension of the Twilight Zone. Because it definitely, I mean, you could see shot angles in there. I mean, if I wanted to pick up one of these issues and try shooting it now, I feel like I could. I feel like you storyboarded it almost 100% for me.
I'm glad you picked up on that. You're completely right about that. And, you know, like there's another episode or story, sorry, called Cold Calculation. And that's done in black and white, actually, to even closer approximate the old Twilight Zones. Not only is it done black and white, it takes place on a spaceship where the ship and the uniforms, mm-hmm. I told the artist, use those same Forbidden Planet designs that were reused in the Twilight Zone and a bunch of other stuff back in the 60s. So, and so the artist did a beautiful job on that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Is that in the collection that you read?
It was. In fact, I finished reading that about 10 minutes before I texted you to get the conversation rolling. So,
yeah, so it's the same thing. Do it like it would have been produced originally, right down to, you know, those uniforms and models that they would have had, you know, in the studios and the back lots that they would have had to shoot them on.
Yeah, and it like I said, it just lends itself to making the whole experience feel very authentic and very, very much an extension of the Twilight Zone. And that's why I feel like it's like I'm in the Twilight Zone reading that. So
if I can ask you a question, pardon me for taking over. I am curious about how the jailbreak story hit you and how you would summarize it since you're not me.
It hit me a little different than I would say Stumbling Distance did. I felt like it was a really well self-contained story. It makes you really examine, it's going to sound weird when I say it out loud, pets, animals. We keep these animals in our homes. We feed them. We placate them. We feed them attention and play with them. And
give them treats.
And give them treats and make them happy, all the while keeping them essentially in captivity. And they're never really happy unless they're able to accept that captivity. Because, and I've had experiences with animals that have been part feral that I've tried to give a home to and to foster, and it's not ever gone well, as with your astronaut character. I feel like it was kind of showing us the other side of this animal captivity that we call pets.
Great. Well, thank you for that. I just, it's been so long since that's been out, and I, and since I wrote it, I was just curious about how that one struck you. And it sounds like you picked up on everything I was laying down there. So that's great. You know, since we're talking, since we're pals now, let me just draw your attention to one more. And I don't know if it was in the collection you read or not, but it seems to be just more relevant the longer time passes. And it was called Takers. Was Takers in there?
Takers was in there.
Okay. So Takers is about just kind of a really blatantly Rand Paul type of pandering, extreme right-wing politician with absolutely no compassion whatsoever.
None.
And this guy, his name in the story was something like
Galt
Randall. Yeah. It's a pretty obvious Ayn Rand type of name. He is mystically or otherwise transported back to the Dust Bowl. And he comes across these people, these poor people struggling in the Dust Bowl era, and tries out his makers and takers stuff on them. And it doesn't end real well for him. I'm not a fan of my own work any more than I'm a fan of like listening to my own voice, looking in the mirror, any of that stuff. But I think that just in terms of a story that resonates with where we are right now and what we're seeing, I mean, we're seeing people being forced to go back to work when it's obvious they're going to get sick and die just so they can,
save money on unemployment insurance.
Yeah. And it all ties back in with what I mentioned earlier about Serling being just absolutely fulminating mad at you know, greed and cruelty. And that's one that's been, that I think might resonate with people more now.
Especially if you're one of the eat the rich kind of liberals.
Yes. And bring your condiments if you're going to eat the rich.
It'll be a feast.
They don't taste great.
Well, we're going to take one more quick break, and we will come back and have a little bit more conversation with Mr. Mark Rahner. Okay, so we're back with Mark Rahner. Mark, we were talking about the Twilight Zone. Now, here's a question that came to mind while I was watching the episode, actually, on TV. The Twilight Zone is oftentimes looked upon as a precursor to a lot of the horror genre, or early horror genre on television, at least, and suspense for sure. Do you think that had restrictions on television been a little looser when they were being filmed, that they would have been more visceral and more schlock horror? Or do you think that the restrictions at the time kind of led them to be more subversive with it and more intelligent with how they filmed these things?
I don't think Rod Serling had a schlock horror atom in his DNA, if that mixes science terms. And I also think there's really something to be said for working within limitations and how that forces people to be creative sometimes. It reminds me of an old parable called The Bound Man. Was that a Kafka story? Kafka? I forget. But if you haven't read the story, it's about a circus performer who is tied up in the athletic ways that he evades, a tiger in his cage, are profoundly entertaining to everybody. Then one day somebody thinks they're doing him a solid. They slip in with a knife and cut him loose, and he doesn't know what to do with himself, and he gets killed. It's been a while since I read this story, so if I've gotten any details of that wrong, including the author, I apologize. You got the Google machine right at your fingertips. It'll be easy for you to find The Bound Man. But so in addition to the fact that I don't think Serling would have done any kind of schlock horror if there were fewer limitations, you got to remember that the Twilight Zone existed solely because of his frustration at just being able to talk about issues and depict issues on national TV. And, you know, this wonderful device that was, you know, beaming into people's houses, it wasn't being used for anything worthwhile. It was a bunch of crap. Anything with any hard edges on it, those edges were filed down. They didn't want to upset anybody. They didn't want to upset their advertisers or their viewers. And so this was a Trojan horse of Rod Serling, but it was an entertaining one. I mean, nobody wants to be lectured either. If you look at things like The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street or The Obsolete Man, another great episode, they sort of came close to lectures, but they were also just profoundly entertaining. You got to have both at once. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to just sit there and be lectured at by a bore, and he knew that.
And I think a lot of the old television was very thematic in a way of dealing with culture, as it were. Like, we talked a lot about the original series Star Trek and what Gene Roddenberry was attempting to do quite successfully. I don't mean to say attempting as in he didn't achieve it. But what he did with first on-screen interracial kiss and a lot of different social issues at the time, the very idea of this floating UN in space, this wagon train to the stars, I think is very emblematic of what he was trying to get across and very much in the same vein as trying to take social issues on and handle them in a way that would make them more accessible to people, I guess.
Roddenberry was obsessed with that stuff, at least as much as Sterling, and he was such a giant pain in the ass to the network. That's the real reason Star Trek was canceled and not low ratings. He was such a pain in the ass. In fact, you should have an author named Mark Cushman on your show. He's written big, big doorstop books about the making of the original series, as well as Lost in Space and I Spy. Prolific, prolific writer. And he can tell you more detail about that than I can. But yeah, Roddenberry wanted to push that stuff. You know, allegories for Vietnam. What was the episode? Private Little War. Although, you know, if you're a kid watching that, all you care about is Nancy Kovac in a fur bikini, right?
And as what I love about talking to you about all this stuff is I've got such a keen mind right now to sit down and just really dive back into Green Hornet and Batman and the original series and Twilight Zone and Outer Limits. And it's stuff that I've had sitting around for quite a long time. It's definitely something that's been on my radar before. But, you know, we have a tendency to get so caught up in all the different, because we got such a vast array of media available to us on every orifice, as it were, that it's really difficult to sit down and enjoy the classics, I think, sometimes.
And well, it may be for you, buddy boy. that stuff is my that's my comfort viewing, especially now that we're in a pandemic lockdown. I mean, you know, like you, I watch Game of Thrones and current stuff, and I read as much as I can. I couldn't in 10 lifetimes watch and read and listen to everything I want to, but that stuff I like to keep in the mix because I think it's just fantastic, and there's nothing that was like it before and nothing that's been like it since.
Right. It definitely carved out its own little niche. And
yeah, it's like Mount Fuji. Sometimes it's so big that we forget how big it is and how it's touched everything that we consume now. It's like if you are a big comic book reader, maybe it's hard for you to stop every now and then and take into account what a big influence 1986 was with Miller's The Dark Knight and Alan Moore's The Watchmen. Mm-hmm. Everything you read in comics was touched in some way by that, just the same as everything in our culture, not just TV, was definitely touched by the Twilight Zone and Star Trek and you know, this other stuff to a lesser extent.
Well, see, and that kind of thing is built into me as well. One of my greatest passions is retro video gaming.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
Well, I collect it all. I've got somewhere in the neighborhood of like 80 different systems with about...
If I were to tell you that I own an original old cocktail tabletop Pac-Man game and an Asteroids game.
Love it. There's a company you should look into, and this isn't an advertisement. I'm sure as hell not sponsored by them, but I do give them money, which I think is the backwards way to sponsor. I think they're supposed to give me money, but
yeah, you got to turn that around.
There's a company called New Wave Toys. They do a thing called Replicades, and what they are is
places for replicants to enjoy games,
something like that. They are 1/6 scale arcade cabinets.
Oh, fun.
And so they've got like four or five of them that they've done. And I've only picked up one of them so far. I kickstarted another one that's been put on hold because of the whole coronavirus thing. But I've got a Street Fighter II cabinet sitting in my living room that is about 12 inches tall, fully functional. And they've got one of the ones that the one that I kickstarted that's been on hold is a 1/6 scale version of Dragon's Lair, which the old Don Bluth animated.
Yeah.
Nightmare from Hell.
So fast on that one. Yeah. That one would just make your money evaporate really quickly.
Uh-huh. And it is ridiculously hard, and I don't think I've hardly ever gotten out of the starting gate on that game, but they're sending me one of these days a 1/6 scale cabinet for that, so I'm pretty excited about that. But retro games, that's my bread and butter. I got like 80 different systems and 800 games or so between it all. And
okay, best video game cabinet of all time.
Arcade cabinet?
Uh-huh.
Of all time, that's hard.
The answer is Space Invaders.
I do enjoy Space Invaders. I do. I was going to throw in Centipede, or I was going to throw in Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong's always had a soft spot for it, so.
Both worthy choices, but Space Invaders is beautiful. I've always wanted one of those.
Hey, go ahead and ask me what my favorite pinball machine is.
Oh, what?
Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that's a great one. Yeah.
I mean, I say that with no hyperbole and no fucking spin. That's always been my favorite pinball machine. Introduced magnetic bumpers, and you got Rod Serling's narration in the background of the whole thing. And
yeah, it's really good. I've owned quite a number of pinball machines, but I had to get rid of everything when I moved from Seattle to Los Angeles, and the Twilight Zone was always my holy grail.
Have you never owned one?
Not a Twilight Zone. I've owned about a half dozen other pinball machines, but the Twilight Zone is the one where you're like, you know, when I get that first big movie option or something, that's what I'm gonna reward myself.
And my wife knows that too. I've told her that as well. I said the first time I do anything worthwhile or sell anything worthwhile or yada yada yada, come up on cash, have the space in the house to put it, I said the Twilight Zone's definitely the thing I'm gonna get. So.
Yeah, and I don't want to Shanghai things here, but it's just cool to have pinball machines where you live. People love them when they come over. They're fun to play to get. If you're a writer, you probably know this. You need things to get out of your own head at the end of the day. Pinball's great for that.
I have a pachinko machine that I did that with for a while.
Uh-huh.
But that has to live in the garage right now, so I don't get too much use. Yeah,
they're a little noisy, aren't they?
They are quite noisy.
Yeah.
Well, I really want to thank you, Mark, for taking the time to chat with me during this quarantine.
I just wanted someone to talk to. I'm so lonely.
Somebody send somebody, please.
We can't go any place. We're so lonely.
But it's been fun talking to you. And I definitely, like I said, I'm going to kind of go on a bit of a bender this weekend, I think, with some old Twilight Zone. And my kid's 15. He was showing a little bit of interest when I was watching the one the other day. So I'm going to sit him down and kind of throw him through some of them and see what he thinks. And
I don't have kids, and I envy you the experience of watching it with a kid that age. You're both really lucky. So have fun with that. I'm glad we get to meet too. I didn't know you before this. And so let's stay in touch.
Absolutely, Mark. And I want to thank you all for listening into another episode of the Feel Your Fandom podcast. Like I said, just be safe out there. Take care of everybody. And do what you can to help kick this thing in the ass and get it over with so we can get back to some kind of semblance of normal. And like I always like to tell everybody at the end here, remember that everything is fandom, and fandom is everything. Take care.